From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. On the Sidewalk Bleeding by Evan Hunter. The boy lay bleeding in the rain. He was 16 years old, and he wore a bright purple silk jacket, and the lettering across the back of the jacket read "De Royals." The boy's name was Tony, and the name was delicately scripted in black thread on the front of the jacket, just over his heart. He had been stabbed 10 minutes ago. The knife had entered just below his rib cage and been drawn across his body violently, tearing a wide gap in his flesh. He lay on the sidewalk, with the March rain drilling his jacket and drilling his body, and washing away the blood which poured from his open wound. He had known excruciating pain when the knife had torn across his body, and then sudden comparative relief when the blade was pulled away. He had heard the voice saying, "That's for you, Royal," and then the sound of footsteps hurrying into the rain, and then he had fallen to the sidewalk, clutching his stomach, trying to stop the flow of blood. He tried to yell for help, but he had no voice. He did not know why his voice had deserted him, or why the rain had become so suddenly fierce, or why there was an open hole in his body from which his life ran redly, steadily. It was 11:30 p.m., but he did not know the time. There was another thing he did not know. He did not know that he was dying. He did not know that unless a doctor stopped the flow of blood, he would be dead within a half hour. He lay on the sidewalk bleeding, and he thought only, "That was a fierce rumble. They got me good that time." But he did not know he was dying. He would have been frightened had he known, but in his ignorance he lay bleeding. He wished he could yell for help, but there was no voice in his throat. There was only the bubbling of blood from between his lips whenever he opened his mouth to speak. He lay silent in his pain, waiting for someone to find him. By midnight, if they did not stop the flow of blood, he would be dead. He could hear the sound of automobile tires hushed on the muzzled of rain-swept streets, far away at the other end of the long alley. He lay with his face pressed to the sidewalk, and he could see the splash of neon far away at the other end of the alley, tinting the pavement red and green, slickly brilliant in the rain. He wondered if Laura would be angry. He had left the jump to get a package of cigarettes. He had told her he would be back in a few minutes, and then he had gone downstairs and found the candy store closed. He knew that Alfredo's on the next block would be open until at least 2, and he had started through the alley, and that was when he'd been ambushed. He could hear the faint sound of music now, coming from what seemed a long, long way off, and he wondered if Laura was dancing, wondered if she had missed him yet. Maybe she thought he wasn't coming back. Maybe she thought he'd cut out for good. Maybe she'd leave the jump and go home. He thought of her face, the brown eyes and the jet-black hair. In thinking of her, he forgot his pain a little, forgot that blood was rushing from his body. Someday he would marry Laura. Someday he would marry her, and they would have a lot of kids, and then they would get out of the neighborhood. They would move to a clean project in the Bronx, or maybe they would move to Staten Island when they were married, when they had kids someday. It was 11:35. He heard footsteps at the other end of the alley, and he lifted his cheek from the sidewalk and looked into the darkness and tried to yell, but again there was only a soft hissing bubble of blood on his mouth. The man came down the alley. He had not seen Tony yet. He walked and then stopped to lean against the brick of the building and then walked again. He saw Tony and came toward him, and he stood over him for a long time, the minutes ticking, ticking, watching him and not speaking. Then he said, "What's the matter, buddy, buddy?" Tony could not speak, and Tony could not move. He lifted his face slightly and looked up at the man, and in the rain-swept alley he smelled a sickening odor of alcohol, and then he realized the man was drunk. He did not feel any particular panic. He did not know that he was dying, and so he felt only mild disappointment that the man who had found him was sauced up. The man was smiling. "You fall down, buddy, buddy," he said. "You drunk as I am, buddy, buddy. I feel sick. I really feel sick. Don't go away. I'll be right back." The man lurched away from Tony. He heard his footsteps and then the sound of the man colliding with a garbage can and some mild swearing, and then all was lost in the steady wash of the rain. He waited for the man to come back. It was 11:39. When the man returned, he squatted alongside Tony. He studied him with drunken dignity. "You're gonna catch cold here," he said. "What's the matter? You like laying in the wet?" Tony could not answer. The man tried to focus his eyes on Tony's face. The rain spattered around them. "You like a drink?" Tony shook his head. "You had enough, huh?" Again, Tony shook his head. "I got a bottle. Here," the man said. He pulled the pint bottle from his inside jacket pocket. He uncorked it and extended it to Tony. Tony tried to move, but pain wrenched him back flat against the sidewalk. "Take it," the man said. He kept watching Tony. "Take it." When Tony did not move, he said, "What's the matter? You too good to drink with me?" He kept watching him with the flat, blank eyes of a reptile. "Never mind," he said at last. "I'll have one myself." He tilted the bottle to his lips and then wiped the back of his hand across his mouth. "You're too young to be drinking anyway. Should be ashamed of yourself, drunk and laying down in an alley all wet. Shame, shame on you. I got a good mind call a cop." Tony nodded. "Yes, yes," he tried to say. "Call a cop. Go, call one." "Oh, you don't like that, huh?" The drunk said. "You don't want cop to find you all drunk and wet in an alley, huh? Okay, buddy, buddy. This time you get off easy. I'm a good Joe. That's why." He got to his feet. "This time you lucky," he said. He waved broadly at Tony and then almost lost his footing. "S'long, buddy, buddy," he said. "Wait," Tony thought. "Wait, please. I'm bleeding." "S'long," the drunk said again. "See you around." And then he staggered off up the alley, and Tony watched him go, watched the figure retreat until it passed into the world of red and green neon and automobile tires hushed on the rain-swept muzzle of the street at the end of the long alley far away. It was 11:41. He lay and thought, "Laura, Laura, are you dancing?" The couple came into the alley at 11:43. They ran into the alley together, running from the rain, the boy holding the girl's elbow, the girl spreading a newspaper over her head to protect her hair. Tony lay crumpled against the pavement, and he watched them run into the alley laughing, and then duck into the doorway not 10 feet from him. "Man, what rain," the boy said. "You could drown out there." "I have to get home," the girl said. "It's late, Mario. I have to get home." "We got time," Mario said. "Your people won't raise a fuss if you're a little late. Not with this kind of weather." "It's dark," the girl said, and she giggled. "Yeah," the boy answered, his voice very low. "Mario." "Hmm?" You're standing very close to me." "Hmm?" There was a long silence. Then the girl said, "Oh." Only that single word, and Tony knew she'd been kissed. And he suddenly hungered for Laura's mouth, hungered for it with a fierce, painfully sweet nostalgia. It was then that he wondered if he would ever kiss Laura again. It was then that he wondered if he was dying. No, he thought, "I can't be dying. Not from a little street rumble. Not from just getting cut. Guys get cut all the time. All the time in rumbles. I can't be dying. No, that's stupid. That don't make any sense at all." "You shouldn't," the girl said. "Why not?" "I don't know." "Do you like it?" "Yes." "So?" "I don't know." "I love you, Angela," the boy said. "I love you too, Mario," the girl said. And Tony listened and thought, "I love you, Laura. Laura, I think maybe I'm dying. Laura, this is stupid, but I think maybe I'm dying. Laura, I think I'm dying." He tried to speak. He tried to move. He tried to crawl toward the doorway where he could see the two figures in embrace. He tried to make a noise, a sound, and a grunt came from his lips. And then he tried again, and another grunt escaped his body, a low animal grunt of pain. "What was that?" the girl said, suddenly alarmed, breaking away from the boy. "I don't know," he answered. Go look, Mario. No, wait. Tony moved his lips again. Again, the sound came from him. Mario? What? I'm scared. I'll go see, the boy said. He stepped into the alley. He walked over to where Tony lay on the ground. He stood over him, watching him. You all right? He asked. What is it? Angela said from the doorway. Somebody's hurt, Mario said. Let's get out of here, Angela said. No, wait a minute. He knelt down beside Tony. You cut? He asked. Tony nodded. The boy kept looking at him. He saw the lettering on his jacket, then the Royals. He turned to Angela. He's a Royal, he said. Let's... What? What do you want to do, Mario? I don't know. I don't want to get mixed up in this. He's a Royal. We help him and the Guardians will be down our necks. I don't want to get mixed up in this, Angela. Is he hurt bad? Yeah, it looks that way. What shall we do? I don't know. We can't leave him here in the rain, Angela hesitated. Can we? If we get a cop, the Guardians will find out who, Mario said. I don't know, Angela. I don't know. Angela hesitated a long time before answering. Then she said, I have to get home, Mario. My people will begin to worry. Yeah, Mario said. He looked at Tony again. You all right? He asked. Tony lifted his face from the sidewalk, and his eyes said, please, please help me. And maybe Mario read what his eyes were saying, and maybe he didn't. Behind him, Angela said, Mario, let's get out of here, please. There was urgency in her voice, urgency bordering on the edge of panic. Mario stood up. He looked at Tony again and then mumbled, I'm sorry. And then he took Angela's arm, and together they ran toward the neon splash at the other end of the alley. They're afraid of the Guardians, Tony thought. Why should they be? I wasn't afraid of the Guardians. I never turkeyed out of a rumble with the Guardians. I got hurt. But I'm bleeding. It was 11:49. It was 11 minutes to midnight. The rain was soothing somehow. It was cold rain, but his body was hot all over, and the rain helped to cool him. He had always liked rain. He could remember sitting in Laura's house one time with the rain running down the windows, and just looking out over the street, watching the people running from the rain. That was when he'd first joined the Royals. He could remember how happy he was the Royals had taken him. The Royals and the Guardians, two of the biggest. He was a Royal. There had been meaning to the title. Now in the alley, with the cold rain washing his hot body, he wondered about the meaning. If he died, he was Tony. He was not a Royal. He was simply Tony. And he was dead. And he wondered suddenly if the Guardians who had ambushed him and knifed him had ever realized he was Tony. Had they known that he was Tony, or had they simply known that he was a Royal wearing a purple silk jacket? Had they stabbed him, Tony, or had they only stabbed the jacket and the title? And what good was a title if you were dying? I'm Tony, he screamed wordlessly. For Christ's sake, I'm Tony. At 11:51, the old lady stopped at the other end of the alley. The garbage cans were stacked here, beating noiselessly in the rain. The old lady carried an umbrella with broken ribs, carried it with all the dignity of a queen. She stepped into the mouth of the alley, a shopping bag over one arm. She lifted the lids of the garbage cans delicately, and she did not hear Tony grunt, because she was a little deaf and because the rain was beating a steady, relentless tattoo on the garbage cans. The old lady was a little deaf and a little tired. She had been searching in garbage cans for the better part of the night. She collected her string and her newspaper and an old hat with a feather on it from one of the garbage cans, and a broken footstool from another of the cans, and then she delicately placed the lids and lifted her umbrella high and walked out of the alley mouth with queenly dignity. She had worked swiftly and soundlessly. When she left the alley, it was only 11:53, only 7 minutes from midnight. The alley looked very long now. He could see people passing at the other end of it. And he wondered who the people were, and he wondered if he would ever get to know them. Wondered who it was on the Guardians who had stabbed him, who had plunged the knife into his body. That's for you, Royal, the voice had said. And then the footsteps, his arms being released by the others, the fall to the pavement. That's for you, Royal. Even in his pain, even as he collapsed, there had been some sort of pride to knowing he was a Royal. Now there was no pride at all. Now with the rain beginning to chill him, with the blood pouring steadily between his fingers, he knew only a sort of dizziness, and within the giddy dizziness he could only think, I want to be Tony. It was not very much to ask of the world. He watched the world passing at the other end of the alley. He lay unnoticed, and the world passed him by. The world didn't know he was Tony. The world didn't know he was alive. He wanted to say, "Hey, I'm alive. Hey, look at me. I'm alive. Don't you know I'm alive? Don't you know I exist?" He felt very weak and very tired. He felt alone and wet and feverish and chilled, and he knew he was going to die, and the knowledge made him suddenly sad. He was not frightened. For some reason, he was not frightened. He was only filled with an overwhelming sadness that his life would be over at 16. He felt all at once as if he had never done anything, never seen anything, never been anywhere. There were so many things to do, and he wondered why he never thought of them before. Wondered why the rumbles and the jumps and the purple jacket had always seemed so important to him before, and now they seemed like such small things in a world he was missing, in a world that was rushing past at the other end of the alley. "I don't want to die," he thought. "I haven't lived yet, so why should I die?" It seemed very important to him that he take off the purple jacket. He was very close to dying, and when they found him, he did not want them to say, "Oh, it's a royal." With great effort, he rolled over onto his back. He felt the pain tearing at his stomach when he moved, a pain he did not think was possible. But he wanted to take off the jacket. If he never did another thing, he wanted to take off the jacket. The jacket had only one meaning now, and that was a very simple meaning. If he had not been wearing the jacket, he would not have been stabbed. The knife had not been plunged in hatred of Tony. The knife had hated only the purple jacket. The jacket was a stupid, meaningless thing that was robbing him of his life. He wanted the jacket off his back. With an enormous loathing, he wanted the jacket off his back. He lay struggling with the sleek, shiny material. His arms were heavy and the pain ripped fire across his body whenever he moved, but he squirmed and fought and twisted until one arm was free and then the other, and then he rolled away from the jacket and he lay quite still, breathing heavily, listening to the sound of his breathing and the sound of the rain and thinking, "Rain is sweet. I'm Tony." She arrived with the policeman at 12:05. She had found him in the alleyway at 12:01, a minute past midnight. She had left the dance to look for him, and when she found him, she knelt beside him and said, "Tony, it's me, Laura." He had not answered her. She had backed away from him, tears springing into her eyes, and then she had run from the alley hysterically, and she had not stopped running until she found the cop. And now, standing with the cop, she looked down at him, and the cop rose and said, "He's dead." And all the crying was out of her now. She stood in the rain and said nothing, looking at the dead boy on the pavement and looking at the purple jacket that rested a foot away from his body. The cop picked up the jacket and turned it over in his hands. "A royal, huh?" he said. The rain seemed to beat more steadily now, more fiercely. She looked at the cop and very quietly said, "His name is Tony." The cop slung the jacket over his arm. He took out his black pad and flipped it open to a blank page. "A royal," he said. Then he began writing. The Seventh Grave by Van Anson Lister. The old-timey wino on the North Avenue Bridge seems to know where he is going. His shoulder bag swings against his baggy corduroys in well-rehearsed rhythm. Beneath the wide lapel jacket, he wears at least 6 shirts, even though it is not cold. Looking over the railing at the east end of the bridge, he shakes his head and crosses the street to look over the opposite rail. Odd, he thinks. No trails. He eases his frail-looking body around the end of the rail into the thick bushes, and hugging the concrete of the bridge, he pushes his way down the slope to the river. Since the city of Milwaukee consumes more beer per capita than any city in the U.S., the old wino is very alone. The Milwaukee Road Railway runs along the west bank of the river, so the bridge is high and wide and long to allow the train to come and go beneath the bridge. Along the river is a perfect wino bridge, but this is Beer City, USA, and winos rarely trespass here. Beer drinkers prefer bars or parking lots or alleys or beaches. They never sit under bridges. Bridges are the sole province of the winos of the world. There's a silent beauty and an art to sitting under bridges that only winos know. The traffic noises and shouting of cabbies and children are muted by the dense foliage and trees along the riverbank. The sounds drift down from another world. Sunlight reflects off the river to dance on the dark belly of the bridge. Between the arched concrete pilings is a bald spot of hard-packed dirt where nothing ever grows. The sun never shines. Here the winer builds a small fire in an ancient circle of stones in the center of the clearing that must surely have been used in bygone days to chart the rising of the moon. An old coffee can of river water boils gently in the circle of stones. Filleted chunks of catfish churn slowly around in a stew of roots and greens. The fishing line tied to a crooked limb still dangles in the water. While the stew cooks, the whiner wanders out into the thicket to piss. There are no trails. Not even adventurous children play here, he realizes. He is thinking he could camp here for weeks, undetected, when he sees a brake man across the river waving to him friendly. He watches him walk the train, stooping between boxcars to couple air hoses, climbing steel rungs to release brakes. The brake man hasn't seen a wino here in Beer City for months. When he clocks out at the yard office, he will be inspired to purchase a couple of bottles of wine for old time's sake. The wino's name is Sinbad, and he has sailed the seven seas as a merchant seaman. He has a steel plate in his skull where the doctors once peeked into his brain and cut out a black demon that lurked there. He wears a beret to cover the patch of odd-colored skin where no hair will ever grow. The beret is black to remind him of the demon. There is a grave where Sinbad is pissing in the bushes. He shakes the last drops away and fumbles with his zipper as he leans through the dense foliage for a closer look. There's a rotting wooden cross with the name Rangoon carved on it, lying fallen on the ground. The grave has been desecrated by some marauding mongrel. The bones of a cat are scattered around a shallow indentation in the soft loam of the forest floor. Sinbad reads the grave. The steel plate in his skull prickles. It is the steel plate, he claims, that gave him this gift. He can know about things just by touching them. He places the scattered bones back in the hole, covers them, and writes the marker, shoving the point deep into the black loam while he talks to the ghost of Rangoon as dappled sunlight plays on the foliage. Rangoon was a wino. His masters were fond of wine and often let him drink from their glasses. It is quite appropriate that they buried him here in Wino Paradise. They were a young couple very much in love. They wanted a child, but the girl had problems, ovarian tumors, the doctor said. So Rangoon became a child to them, an only child, a big blue-eyed lynx point Siamese, terribly intelligent, as near to sentience as only certain Egyptian cats or very few parrots and perhaps porpoises can be, and terribly pampered, until the joyful day the girl announced her proud pregnancy, her impossible miraculous pregnancy, and Rangoon was no longer pampered. He was all but ignored in the couple's parental bliss. He grew weak and sick and went away and died of loneliness while the couple practiced their lamas, the boyer and la leche, for natural childbirth. There was no longer room in their lives for a sentient cat, but they wept when a neighbor told them where to find the body, and they carried him in a cardboard box across the North Avenue Bridge from their apartment to bury him on the riverbank. They shared a little bottle of wine under the bridge, a toast to the dead and to the new life in her belly. The child was stillborn, and Sinbad finds that grave near Rangoon's. Unmarked, the couple had tried to have the child at home alone. The husband as midwife, they blamed themselves, and their guilt ate them alive. They had no friends in Milwaukee. The husband's job had brought them here from Houston. They were alone with no one to share their grief, and they wanted to hide what had happened. It was against the law, after all. They could have been charged with murder for not having an authorized state-licensed doctor present, even though they trained well and studied the books. Even though it was not their fault, it was the black demon's tumors. To hide their shame and guilt, they buried the fetus and placenta in a little grave under the bridge. But they hid this grave deeper in the black loam and foliage and left no marker. They drank a big bottle of wine under the bridge to drown their sorrow. The husband began drinking heavily, coming home late, missing work. He was a standards analyst, brought in by a local foundry to supervise time studies. He hated it. He wanted to finish and get back home to Texas, but the work dragged on and on. One night, in a drunken rage, he struck his lovely wife too hard with a half-empty bottle of wine. Sinbad finds her grave in the black loam not far from the child. He reads it and knows that she was not sad to die. She could not bear to live with her guilt and had taunted her husband cruelly, questioning his masculinity in the feeble hope that he would break and lash out at her and her misery. He did, and only Sinbad knows it was a suicide. Sinbad has crawled deep into the foliage. His hands and knees are damp and black. Back at his small fire in the circle of stones in the clearing under the bridge, there's a dark shadow of a man with a brown paper bag in his hand that it can only be a liter of wine. Sinbad's bones, old as the sea, creak like straining mizzenmast in a high wind as he crawls back towards the fire. The steel plate in his skull stings. Tells him the shadow man is not a wayward wino, it is him. Sinbad crawls through the dense foliage toward his fate, and cringes, suddenly trembles. He has crawled across another grave, a wino stabbed to death when he passed out in a drunken stupor because he was too near the graves. Stabbed to death by him, the shadow man waiting by the fire. Sinbad brushes at the loam, and a skull grins up at him through black rotting leaves. Not just one, he reads. He glances around through the whispering leaves and sees the skulls of two more winos, drinking black loam wine. Howdy, the shadow man says. Hello, Sinbad recognizes the brakeman from across the river as he walks towards the fire, brushing black loam from his baggy knees. I seen you from across the river there, the brakeman says, pointing to the tracks across the river. Don't see many folks over here. I thought you might like to share a jug or two. I sneak down here a lot. It's quiet, peaceful. He extends the brown wrapped jug to Sinbad. Mad Dog or Thunderbird? He pulls another jug, a flat hip flask, from his pocket, offering it an alternative. Don't talk much, huh? Hungry? He pulls a can of sardines from his other hip pocket. Sinbad notices the worn black buck knife sheath on his wide leather belt. Well, just trying to be friendly. What was you doing back in them bushes? Pissing? Oh, nothing personal, just wondered. Sinbad accepts the flat bottle of Mogan David 2020 and sips it carefully. No, not poison, that's not his style. The knife on his belt. Keep an eye on that knife. Gets real lonely down here sometimes, the brakeman says. I'll bet, thinks Sinbad. Terribly lonely. He drinks long on the Mad Dog and finally says, You been a brakeman long? Nah. Couple years. Hey, I'm hungry. What you got boiling? Can I join you? The shadow man squats down without invitation on the hard-packed dirt by the fire. Looks like fish. Smells good. He drinks from the bottle of Thunderbird, swallowing huge gulps like only Texas winos can swallow. Sinbad watches him silently. Guess I'll eat these sardines, he says. He pulls the folding buck hunter from its black leather pouch, opens it with one hand, and cuts into the lid of the can with a sharp stainless blade, cutting up and down expertly. The tin lid crinkles up and away from the sardines. Sinbad's eyes are riveted on the gleaming blade, up and down, flashing reflections of sunlight from the shimmering river. When he finishes, the man leans forward and places the knife open on a rock by the fire, and eats the sardines with his fingers. There's yellow oil on the stainless blade dripping slowly onto the rock. Nice blade, says Sinbad, reaching for it. Mind if I see? The man starts to object, but the knife is already in Sinbad's quick hand. He reads it. He reads the crushing shame and guilt, and the horrible loneliness of the shadow man. Their eyes meet and are locked in a fierce embrace. The man sees understanding in Sinbad's eyes. You found them, didn't you? Sinbad lays the knife back on the rock and sits cross-legged by the warm fire, staring into the shadow man's hollow eyes. I'm going to do you a big favor, son. Thank you. Sinbad raises a silver derringer from the baggy folds of his pants and shoots the man in the forehead. The sardine can flies backward to splash into the river, and the man flops sharply back, legs still crossed, to stare unseeing at the reflected sunlight dancing on the dark belly of the bridge. He is smiling. Sinbad buries him under the bridge near his wife and son, and hops a boxcar headed south. With a bottle of Thunderbird and a bottle of Mad Dog, he rides the empty car to warmer places, friendlier bridges.